You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hey there, what a wonderful day. The sun is shining, the birds are chirping, and my dog is scaring me. So I'm trying to record this. It's a little awkward. If you've been with me for a while, you know how important I think communication is to innovation. You can have all the great ideas in the world, but if nobody's listening, who cares? Well, today's guest is going to help you ensure that your ideas get heard. And you know what I really appreciate about this interview is not just some of the tools, but the science behind why it works as well. Steve Woodruff is known for being the king of clarity in a world full of noise. His company, Clarity Fuel, helps individuals and teams communicate with power, and his new book, Clarity Wins, helps people of all levels get their message heard above the noise. Noise, by the way, that's what Steve thinks is our biggest competitor. All right, time to listen in.
Steve, thank you so much for joining me today. I have to admit, I'm a little bit on edge and in how I frame my questions, because we're talking all about clarity and communication.
Well, Tamara, it's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, everybody on the planet has to work on clarity, including me. So I think that some of the principles we'll discuss today, you'll find and your listeners will find, are of universal application. There's always a need for clarity.
Well, maybe you can help with my fundamental issue is I talk and think at the same time, right? So I'm like, I'm saying something, but then my brain's actually going about what's going to happen next. And then it ends up in one sentence that makes no sense to anyone.
Tomorrow, I cannot help you with that.
It'll slow my brain down. So listen, let's get to know you. What's your favorite innovative brand or business, and why do you love it so much?
I guess, you know, it's probably not a surprise that I would say Apple. And I'm sure for many people it's that way. But what I admire about Apple over the years is that their core, as far as innovation, has been the human technology interface and how to make that better. And it hasn't just been one thing. They started with computers, but then they moved on to other parts of technology, into software and devices, and they've maintained that innovative DNA throughout the entire cycle of the company. And I really, really admire that. That's hard to do.
You know, it's so hard. It's interesting. I think that Apple's had some ups and downs after Steve Jobs passed in terms of what they brought to market and how innovative it really is. But at the end of the day, you always know what they stand for and who they are.
Yeah, and it goes beyond just the products. I mean, they broke some ground in the way that they advertised in the 1984 advertising and some of their other advertising. And I think they have one of the most innovative and wonderful taglines, you know, Think Different, which has this little grammatical edge to it. It should be Think Differently, but they took a different direction. And they created this idea of join the club of people who are different. Very, very creative.
Yeah, they really are. So I want to start the rest of this conversation talking about the title of your book, because I think that kind of sets the framework for all of our conversation today. So the title is Clarity Wins. Why does clarity win?
Well, no matter what our endeavor and no matter what we create or what we offer or what our market is, if we are not able to clearly communicate to our prospective customers or to our employees or to investors or to other people, we lose. It's just there's this magic thing that has to occur in every endeavor, and that is getting our point across clearly. And as you know, and I have certainly experienced over the years, a lot of very smart people and very savvy people technologically cannot speak coherently. And it is one of the things that is the make or break in how any business will succeed.
I want to ask you a question about that, because I 100% agree. And you and I were talking offline a minute ago about how important it is to get buy-in from the people around you for whatever it is that you're working on, to your point, whatever your endeavor is. Sometimes it seems like we think we're being clear and the other person's not getting it. And I just want you to address that, because is that, you know what, at the end of the day tomorrow, you just simply weren't as clear as you thought, or is there something else going on there?
Oh, it's a very common knowledge. I love the quote from George Bernard Shaw, which is, the greatest illusion in communication is the illusion that has taken place. And so we think that we have communicated. We think that because we have said words into the air, that they have been received, processed, understood, and remembered. But that is absolutely not the case. We are competing with an incredible amount of noise in the environment, and each person's mind has a different set of information in their head about how words are defined and what they mean. So unless we master the art of getting people on the same page by using human-ready, simple language, by defining our terms, by making sure that we are arriving collaboratively at a shared meaning, we cannot assume that communication has taken place.
So before we dig into the five elements of clarity and some other questions I want to ask based on what you said, I want to actually tackle something that you mentioned in the very beginning, which is noise, right? That we're all taking in so much information. Is that, as you talk about it, the biggest enemy that we're facing in business today? Is it all this noise? Is that really it?
That's I open the book by saying that essentially we all have the same competitor. We tend to think of our competitors as this company or that product. But in fact, we're all in a war for attention. That's the big deal. And the noise, the amount of stimulation going on where our brains are having to process and filter out a billion bits of information per second. I think it was a million, not a billion. But and the brain has this wonderful faculty called the reticular activating system for filtering out and finding what's new and relevant and interesting. And so the key to clarity is that we've got to make our communications get through the reticular activating system. We have to rise above the noise in order to be noticed. And that's a high bar. When we're competing with Netflix and email and computers in our pocket and audio and all this other stuff that is really far more interesting than our message, quite frankly, and that is surrounding every one of our listeners every day.
I want to dig into the reticular activating system, because I've been doing a bunch of reading for that for my book. So I got all excited when you said that. I was like, oh my God, he's going to talk about it. He's going to go to the RAS. It's very exciting. So the other thing it does is it tries to match what you already believe, right? Because it filters out what is in contrast to what you believe. So if you believe you're shy, it'll look for, you know, validation that you're shy. If you believe that there's only one path of doing something, it'll look for validation that, you know, that is accurate and all those other paths are inaccurate. How does that then, how do you manage that with the fact that, hey, you got to rise above that noise to even get through a system that's simply trying to, in many ways, keep status quo?
Yeah, the reticular activating system, it does have a pattern matching component to it. And that's part of the survival mechanism that the way we survive is we have to somehow notice, and this is at a subliminal level, what's different in the environment and what is unusual and what shouldn't be there. So the RIS is always tuned into what is new and interesting. But the other thing we have to know about it that's crucial is that the reticular activating system of every single brain is tuned into one radio station. And that's WIIFM, what's in it for me? So that is the ultimate thing that we're filtering for, is relevance. Does this matter to me? Does this matter? Does it feed my survival? Does it take care of a need? And so our communications have to be made RAS friendly. That is, we've got to immediately show somebody why it's relevant to listen to us or to process this message. And we got to do it quickly, within 15 or 30 seconds, or that's it, opportunity lost.
You know, Steve, what I love about what you're talking about here is I think it puts some real meat behind why I love the what's in it for them. Because I think oftentimes we think of that as, oh, I just need to adjust my language because the other person has an ego, right? Like we're all selfish. But at the end of the day, we are hardwired to be that way.
Correct. It's just biology. I mean, we can surrender to it. There's no moral element to it. We're all self-interested. We're all looking to survive. We're all looking to thrive. And it's not really a matter that somebody's arrogant or egotistical. It's just that they're human. And so they want to know at a completely unconscious level. The RAS is tuning into this, you know, does this matter? Does it matter to me? And so it really does behoove us to think before we communicate, what is going to ring this person's bell and why? And then to bake that into however it is that we're going to say it.
So if I would tell me if I'm wrong, I'm going to assume that most of us, most of the time, accidentally, are just adding to the noise.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. How? Unfortunately, that's why there's so much of it. How do we break from that and get to clarity? And I know you talk about the five elements, so maybe this is the place to ask about that.
The way we have to break through is we somehow have to rise above all that noise. And one of the ways, one of the chief ways, and it's the end point I try to arrive at in all communication, is to use the shortcuts that get through. So an analogy. So here's an analogy for you. The noise problem is like all those scientific documentaries you've seen of those crowds of penguins on an ice floe in the Antarctic. And they all look the same. And they all sound the same. And, you know, how would you distinguish one of those penguins out of that entire group of them? And that is the essence of the noise problem. We're just another penguin on the floe until we find some way to look or sound different. And so that comes down many ways to language. How can we say something that is going to get through? And one of the chief ways we do that is by symbolic language, the use of metaphor, story, illustration, and word pictures. We want to create word pictures. And that's part of the magic, that in making our communications human ready, eventually we want to move it to something that creates an image in the mind that is easily latched onto and easily remembered.
So can you give me an example of something, and maybe if you can show the contrast of like maybe how I would communicate it in a way that would add to the noise versus in what you're just saying with symbolic language?
Sure. So part of my work, when I launched my company 13 years ago, I am a kind of a unique bird. I'm a matchmaking consultancy between outsource training providers and commercial pharmaceutical training departments. So I worked on the vendor side for 10 years, and then I saw this constant problem that a lot of the training departments in these big pharma companies didn't know how to select good vendors, and a lot of these vendors didn't know how to articulate their value, and I decided to set up a referral matchmaking consultancy, which I still do to this day. And but that's a lot of words to describe what I do. If I say I'm a plumber, you know what that means. If I say I'm a lawyer, you know what that means. What in the world is a matchmaking consultancy referral network thing? So about 18 months in, I came up with it. Oh, I'm the eHarmony of pharma training. Mm. And by just coming up with that one analogy, very simple, I could attach my identity into an existing memory hook. People know what an eHarmony is, and bingo, communicate in a way that was accessible, memorable, and easy.
That's why you see with some, I think, particularly really far out innovation, they say things like, we're the Uber of, we're the yes. Hilton, or whatever it is. You're right. And I never thought exactly. of it before. I used to sometimes think, oh, they should just be their own thing. But you're right. It's hard for me to understand what they even are without that link.
We need shortcuts. The brain craves shortcuts because we only have so much processing power. So one of the most ingenious things that any company or brand or individual can do is to find that analogy find that word picture that will make it simple for someone to say, oh, I get it. Because typically you've got a combination of something known and something unknown. And so the brain wants to attach the concept to something it's familiar with.
You know, this is on the product side, but I talk about flax milk. And mm-hmm. the reason it's called milk isn't because it's actually milk. It's because without that word, how do I use this product? Like, I wouldn't know what to do with it. It's like flax juice. I don't know. Like, what do I? So I totally hear what you're saying. I want to dig a layer deeper in what you just said, because that was a brilliant example. And the difference was totally, I totally got it. And Launch Street listening, I'm sure you did too. The first part I was like, Like, my brain had to work hard to understand what you did. And then when you said that eHarmony, the eHarmony of, I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. But the other thing that I think you clearly showed and you alluded to earlier was the importance of simple language. Yes. And I think all too often we get really jargony and complicated. Why is simple language so important?
Simple language is important for the reason that we've alluded to already. The brain doesn't want to work too hard. So if we can make it simple, then it's quick, it's easy, and it's accessible, and that's doing the brain a favor. The other is that we're all subject to what Steven Pinker of Harvard calls the curse of knowledge, which is when we are immersed in our own field, our own area of expertise, we have absorbed a whole bunch of ideas, information, specialized terms, acronyms, and we start spitting them out. And we assume that everybody else knows them when they don't. And you have undoubtedly, as I have, sat in meetings where people have started spewing a bunch of information that's very specific to their category. And you're going, I don't look like an idiot if I ask, you know, what's a GQ7? And this happens all the time. And what happens is we lose our audience. People shut us down if they do not understand. So one of the things, one of the tricks that we can use is to be aware of this phrase and use this phrase when we're talking to people. And what I mean by that is, so if you use a term and you think there's a chance that it's unfamiliar, you just explain it in simple terms and you're saving that other person the embarrassment of having to ask. And you're also ensuring that you're actually communicating effectively.
You know, so you just brought back a memory to me. I have to share. I was working with a very large consumer goods company, and we were in a meeting. I was an outside consultant, and there were about 12 of them internally in the room. And this company is really known for their acronyms, and they were throwing them out all over the place. And the only reason I could ask what they meant is because I was new, brand new to the room. But that's it, right? I'm the only one. But I could see the glazing on the faces happening as people were talking. And so I, you know, at some point I said, I'm so sorry. Perhaps this is my question. Bear with me as I'm new to the team. What does that mean? And as they started to explain it, somebody else who was at the company said, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you asked. I didn't know either. It turned out half the room didn't know what the person was talking about, because we all assume that everybody gets the very complicated, not just acronyms, but other stuff like that too. Turned out half the room had no idea what anyone was talking about.
Happens all the time. And that's why I'm sort of at war against jargon, because jargon obscures meaning. It doesn't really help meaning. It obscures it. And I think we have to teach ourselves to speak in the simplest terms. One of my sons was in the Marines for 4.5 years. And when he and his buddies would get together and do what I call mill speak, I mean, talk about acronyms. It was like a completely different language. And they all knew what they were talking about, but I was utterly lost. And one of the struggles, actually, that people have coming out of the military, and I had to work with my son on this, and others have done a lot of good work with veterans, is you have to help people translate from mill speak into normal business language. And to understand how people in the business world view things that are of value and what those terms are. So there's this translation issue that has to go on if we're to really make any progress in communicating well.
So when that happens, so if I'm in a room with you and you're starting to talk in your jargony, big expert, hoity-toity speak, and I have no idea what you're saying, and I start to glaze over, why is that? Is that because I don't want to look stupid, just fair, right? I don't want to act like I don't know what I'm doing. Or is there a primal reason of the brain going, oh, I, or maybe it's both. I, you know, I don't know what this means. Too much work, shut down.
Yeah, the primal reason is I have no idea if this is important to me. Mm-hmm. And because I can't figure out if it's important to me, and I cannot spend the next 20 minutes trying desperately to translate all these terms and interpret and figure, I'm out, I'm done. And it's not even a conscious decision. I mean, your brain just does it. So, but here's the thing that we got to understand about this. Think of the opportunity lost. If somebody's in a group with you and you know a bunch of key people, some of whom may be really great referral potential partners, and you're talking to somebody who cannot communicate, they may be shutting off the next $1 million opportunity only because Tamara did not have a clue what they were saying.
Yeah.
This is not optional. We've got to learn to make ourselves clear.
Yeah, no, I'm slightly silent because I'm just thinking about all the times where I think I probably overspoke. You know, it was just too high of a level, didn't make sense. The jargon, and I'm in the innovation business, so I love creative language. But it confuses people. And sometimes when I look at people's business cards and it says like chief happiness officer, chief like get it done officer, I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Nope.
And so it's like that clarity and that simplicity is so important. So in your book, you talk about the five elements of clarity. What are they?
So the five elements of clarity are actually relatively straightforward. Everybody actually knows the words, but I repurpose it. I did some R&D, which is another word for ripoff and duplication, of the core principles or questions of journalism: who, what, where, why, how, when. And it turns out that especially when it comes to positioning a brand or a company or a product, these questions are the key to strategically defining who you are, where you fit, and who you're serving. So the what is exactly in detail, simple language. What exactly are you offering? What is the thing that you are trying to fix, the pain you're fixing? The who is, what is the detailed description of the person most likely to be feeling that pain and the ability to open a wallet to fix it? And I mean, we're getting right down to titles and roles and not just anybody involved in marketing. Maybe it's CMOs, chief marketing officers. Maybe it's CFOs if it's going to be involved with finances. So you have to articulate for your own purpose, as well as your salespeople and your referral partners, who exactly am I going after? And then the why is, what is it that's creating a problem or a pain? What makes somebody say, I gotta get this fixed? The how is, what's the unique thing that you're bringing to the table, the magic, the secret sauce, the something special that makes what you do unique or worthy of somebody to put in some money? And then the where has two levels. One is a geographic where. Do you do your work locally? Are you regional? Do you have a national scope? Are you a global scope? Are you an online, therefore virtual? Those are important things because, you know, if you're local and you do most of your work, say, in the Denver area, and I know somebody in Argentina that sounds like a good fit, well, that's not a good fit. Because you don't work in Argentina.
Right.
And then there's a where that's at a another level, and that is, where in the marketplace is this person? In the automotive sector? Do they just work in the financial sector? Are they in marketing? Are they in sales, HR? Once we get these lines drawn about where the pigeonhole is, where the sweet spot is, who and what, it's painting this portrait of here's who I help and here's the pain I fix. That's what activates other people to refer you, because now they know who to refer you to. Mm. If they just know you do marketing stuff, 99% of the people they think of may have marketing needs but won't be the right referral for you. if you paint an accurate picture using those five questions, you'll be telling me exactly who I need to send to you.
You know, before I ask you the next question, I just want to say I really appreciate the emphasis on people like the pain and opening their wallet and money, because I do think that whatever your idea, solution, whatever it is only as good as someone else's willingness to pay you for it or approve it or give you budget. And if you can't get that, the idea is pretty worthless.
Yeah, you might have a brilliant idea, but if it's got to solve enough pain that somebody wants to pay. So, you know, headache medicine, people will pay a lot of money to fix a headache because the pain is intense and they've got to get some kind of solution. And people will pay thousands, millions of dollars for different things if we can just show that it's going to fix a very real problem for them.
So we give us walk us through this. Like, I'd love to hear a real world example through all those and kind of break it down for us so we can really get it.
So when you let's take the example of, say, a financial planner. OK, so I've done clarity sessions with a number of financial planners, and like real estate people, bankers, lawyers, financial planners, they all tend to, you know, you put them in one bucket and you just say, yeah. OK, another one of those. But in fact, financial planners could have a totally different set of clientele. One I worked with, extremely high net worth people who were more advanced in years, who were very specifically thinking of their legacy that they're leaving behind, who already were contributing a specific percentage of their income to charitable causes. We had delineated, you know, the key prospect based on all their existing customers and which customers really seemed to be the right ones. And so once we came up with that description, that detailed description, it then became self-evident what it meant to promote the business. We're going to aim at this really small target that has all these characteristics. And in the case of this business, it was going to be really the best thing they could do is referrals, because who knows more of those people than the ones that are already those people. So they didn't need billboards. They didn't need a bunch of young 20-something salespeople. They needed to target this really very tiny strata of high net worth people. But then there are other financial planners that are working more on a local basis with people that are maybe in their 30s and 40s, totally different demographic. And then there are others that are going to be working maybe in a nonprofit type of area. So you can have a financial planner, but that's not enough information. We've got to actually dig down and say, where do you really make that impact? Who are the people that are going to be best utilizing your service? And that only comes through detailed questioning. So a lot of what I do with Clarity is I do a lot of questioning in the first couple of hours, particularly digging into past work, existing clients, trying to figure out what's a really good client look like, what's a bad client look like, what's a good engagement look like, what does the amount of work that you do, you know, is it really a kind of a long-term, ongoing, multi-year thing? Is it a one-shot deal? I was working with one gal, actually, in the pharma industry, who was succeeding very well in pharma sales. And pharma sales, by the way, you're not actually selling a product, making a transaction. You are influencing healthcare professionals and others who hopefully will prescribe or approve, but you're not making a sale. So she was succeeding and she was being moved up and doing great in new roles. But there was something gnawing at her, something not right. And we talked about it and she said, you know, I was happiest when I was selling wireless plans in a kiosk in a mall. And I thought, wow, why?
You don't hear that very often.
Yeah. Because it was a tangible, it was a thing, it was a transaction. I could see the result of my work immediately. And what we arrived at was, you know, not necessarily go back to malls, but she needed to move into an arena that was tangibles. and transactional. She didn't like the idea that there were too many other variables and no way to really trace what was happening, even though she was succeeding and everybody thought the world of her. But it was that one clue was the fact that she really liked selling wireless stuff. Okay, well, why? What's that? And sometimes that's the key that unlocks the differentiator, is something as simple as that.
I hope for Launch Street out there listening that you just take a second, the who, what, where, why, how, when. Did I get it right? Did I miss something?
Yeah, I don't usually use when, except on that occasion, but yeah.
I was close. I don't know where I got close. When from.
Oh, you got the journalist part. The journalists use the when, so.
Oh, got it. Okay, so I was close. But I hope that they like are out there kind of writing that down and thinking that through for whoever they have to get buy-in from, because I think, to your point, I mean, it's such a simple concept. Journalists use it all the time, but really when you start to break it down, that's when you realize, I think, and I know this is true for me, where I have clarity where I thought I had it, but I actually don't.
Mm-hmm. The way I position it is this: there are 7.5 billion people on this planet. Not all of them are your customer. So you're going to have to narrow it down.
Yeah.
So let's narrow it down. And the thing is that you can make a ton of money in a micro niche, as long as you know what that niche is and you have something unique to offer. And for most companies, they really need to niche down and say, this is our target. And a lot of them don't do it. They cast too wide a net, and then they become a generalist or a commodity company, and nobody knows what they stand for.
You know, that's why I very often push back when startups come to me for advice. It happens quite frequently, but they say things like, we'll capture 10% of the first moms market. I'm like, well, what does that really mean? You know, I don't even know, like, who is that really? And I couldn't agree with you more that the businesses that really hyper niche are the ones that do well. And I'll just really quickly as an example throw out there, because it's one of my favorites, is CrossFit. That's for a very distinct group of people who like to fitness in a very specific way.
Yes.
And that's why they're a $1 billion business, because if they had gone out with a general functional fitness mindset, mentality, exercises, I think it would have failed. Now, it was created for the reason of truly getting healthier and stronger, but the brand itself really owns this hyper, hyper specific niche.
Correct. And Peloton has done something similar with their bicycle-based, community-based, online. They have a very specific approach, and they're going after a specific type of person. And so even a mature category like exercise, there's all kinds of opportunity to micro niche. And one of the things I would tell my kids, I have five boys, and they're all grown up now. The youngest is a senior in high school.
Five boys.
And one of them is actually now a marketing consultant. So he's followed dad's path. But I said, everything you look around, when you look around as we drive, every single thing you see, from telephone poles to signs to rocks to everything, is sold. There's a niche. There's a million niches. All you got to do is find one. All you got to do is find one. And there's an incredible amount of opportunity, and it's constantly changing because the marketplace is constantly changing. So we shouldn't be thinking in these narrow terms that opportunity is just this small pie. It's an always evolving pie. And we just have to, part of innovation is looking around and saying, you know, what's missing? Where's a place I could fit? What if we combined this and this? And what if we took this and made it over here? There's no end to opportunities.
So I want to take it a little bit inward for a second, because one of the things that's come out of your work isn't just that outward marketing, branding, business, but also clarity and how it improves collaboration and teamwork. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, because many of my clients are big corporate pharmaceutical companies, I've done workshops for them. I not only have done the matchmaking work, but I've also done workshops. And what has developed my little micro niche, my little tiny pigeonhole as far as workshops and pharma, is becoming this whole idea of how do we create more clear internal communications and internal collaborations. And that grew out of workshops I started to deliver on how to work more effectively with vendors, because working with vendors is effective collaboration. And it turns out that if you can get everybody on the same page, using words the same way, agreeing to a plan that works. And when it comes to projects, I have a bunch of categories, seven different categories that I outline on how to make an effective project. This is all getting people on the same page. And most projects go off the rails, not because of bad intentions, but because people have not actually, in a detailed, simple way, agreed on what's going on. And the illustration I use, which is a very striking one, it makes me horrified and laugh every time I do this, is in 2012, a very rich Russian oligarch decided he wanted to buy a chateau outside of Bordeaux, France. I mean, I wish I had that kind of money. And so he sees this chateau and it needs some exterior work, and there's a couple of outbuildings that need to be knocked down. And so he contracts with a construction firm, which happens to be a Polish group. And so here's this Russian guy contracting with a Polish construction group in Bordeaux, France, to do some work on this chateau. What could go wrong? So he comes back and they have leveled the entire chateau.
Oh.
But they left the shed, the outbuilding. And so something didn't go well on getting everybody on the same page. Something
did not
get communicated in good, clear detail, for sure. And in that case, you could point it to a language problem, multi-language problem. But in point of fact, it's bad project definition, bad project management, bad collaboration skills, and the lack of making sure that everybody clearly did understand led to the wholesale raising of this beautiful chateau.
Do you think so? One of the things I see in these situations, and I'm guilty of this too in teamwork, is so I will communicate something, perhaps it's a direction or my input, my suggestion how to do it. The other person doesn't do it, doesn't take it, doesn't happen right in my mind. Then I think that person's an idiot, right? Like, they're the problem, not me. They're the problem. And I think that's one of the symptoms of what you're talking about, of really they need to work on their collaboration, their teamwork, which ultimately to what you're saying for you is clarity and communication. What are some of the other symptoms that you see that, you know, if I'm listening out there, I'd go, oh, we might have a clarity issue.
Well, one of those is that very thing that you may be involved in a meeting with five people and, you know, 45 minutes in, you make a statement and you are quite sure it's very clear and people have nodded their heads. Well, it may be that the key person there tuned you out, you know, at 10 minutes.
And
right. they theoretically heard what you said, but they didn't. And or maybe they heard it, but they have five other pressing things on their minds that are much more immediate, much more relevant to the moment. And so that got kicked to the back of the line. So I was discussing this with one of my clients actually earlier today, that one of the most important things we can do in bringing clarity in a collaborative setting and realizing that everything's a work in progress and there's no perfect communication. We have to allow people to save face, and by not pointing the finger necessarily in every case and saying, you were wrong, you were stupid, you're an idiot, but by recognizing that there are external forces at work, and whether it's too much distraction or other things that are intruding into people's attention or wrong definition of words, we've got to be able to provide a healthy way in which we say, you know, I think, you know, we had talked about this, but it may be that I didn't make myself entirely clear, or it may be that I didn't actually put a deadline on this, and try to make it safe for people to make mistakes and to come back around and to get clear again without pointing the finger. It's an art form and it requires a bit of humility. And I actually just earlier today had somebody call me, and we had scheduled to talk, and it was even on the calendar next Friday. And he calls expecting us to have a 2.5 hour session today. And we had just set this up yesterday. You know, I could have said, look, the calendar very clearly says tomorrow. We agreed. But, you know, I figured I probably really didn't make it very clear. I may have not made it as clear as I thought I did. And so you just want to pretty much try to diffuse those situations and assume that there are going to be misunderstandings. There will be lack of clarity, and it probably is not always a moral issue or an ethical issue, or the person's an idiot.
You know, one of the things I realized along those lines is when I say to someone, and this is a habit I used to have, you get it, right? Like, we're good?
Yes.
The person on the other side is never going to say to you, nope, have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, not never, yeah. Rarely.
No, you can't do that. And so doing a summary at the end of a meeting, okay, so this is what we've agreed to, is a great way to do it. And also a follow-up email where you outline what you agreed to so that it's actually in writing. It may be that they really did think that we'd agreed to something totally different. And once it's in writing, it's, okay, maybe I didn't understand that.
I want to talk a little bit in the time we have left about better versus different. And, you know, you were talking in the beginning about the reticular activating system and it looking for like something different, unusual, shouldn't be there. And that's how it gets in. Also looking for relevancy. But I think when it comes to noise, we tend to add to it because we just do things a little bit better than the other person, right? A little bit stronger, a little bit faster, a little bit quicker, a little bit smoother, whatever it is, versus trying to be different, which, you know, to kind of your conversation about the RAS and really just the noise in the world that we live in really helps you stand out. And I talk a lot about it in my work, but I would love to hear your perspective on the difference between those two.
I'm all for better. And I think that by and large, it's great to always be better in some way, you know, faster, cheaper, higher quality, whatever the better aspect is. But some of that is a game that you ultimately can't win because somebody can always become better and better and cheaper and faster and whatever. So it can become a race to the bottom where it just is a price war. And that's not ever where we want to be. What we want to be in the minds of people is special, differentiated in a category that can't be challenged. That's what we want. And many times it's there are special things about the user interaction, the user experience that create a bond. So anybody that knows me knows that I have a peculiar attachment to a restaurant here outside of Nashville called Loveless's Cafe. And there are a ton, believe me, a ton of restaurants around here. But I have a fondness for Loveless's that goes back decades because when I had just gotten married and I brought my wife down here and I had lived down here prior and I'd gotten exposed to Loveless's because I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville. And so I had some knowledge. And so I bring my bride down, and these were in the days, some of your readers may not even know what these are, traveler's checks. So you didn't want to travel with cash.
Don't worry, I know what it is.
You know what traveler's checks are. What I mean by that is, so, you know, these are pieces of paper that are replacements for cash.
Right.
And the advertisement is traveler's checks. You know, they're as good as money, taken at 6 jillion places around the world, blah, blah, blah. So we didn't even have a bank account set up. I had no cash on me, but I had these traveler's checks. We went and had this wonderful meal. And then I pull out my traveler's checks and the lady says, oh, I'm sorry, honey, we don't take those. And I felt awful. They also didn't take credit cards. And I just felt terrible. And then she said, that's all right, dear, in the southern way, you know, patting on my forearm. Once you get your bank account set up, you just send us the check. Here's the bill. And they won my affection forever with that one move. And then all of my subsequent experiences with Loveless's over the years have been very positive as well. I mean, this is one of those restaurants that just always hits it and so friendly. And so they have earned blog posts. They've earned a mention in my book. They've earned a mention on this podcast. They've earned a mention all over the place. I have sold Loveless's. My 5 sons all love Loveless's. Everybody loves Loveless's. Why? Because they did something special. And also they do have the best biscuits in the world, by the way. So they do something better, but they created an attachment, and that's what we want to do. We want to position ourselves in the minds of people as different and wonderful. And, you know, we want people to not just be customers, but be advocates. They love us. They want us to succeed.
So I can't believe we're getting close to out of time. So before we miss it, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
So my website is clarityfuel, all one word, .com. The book is on Amazon, and I made a short link called claritywins.org that goes directly to Amazon, where you can download an e-copy or order a soft cover. On Facebook, I'm King of Clarity. I'm easy enough to find on LinkedIn, S. Woodruff. And pretty much anywhere you just Google Steve Woodruff, you'll find me. I've made enough noise over the last 10 or 15 years that Google knows where I am.
But you haven't added to the noise. That's the difference.
Well, probably I have some, but I've tried to add to the clarity too.
All right, Steve, this has been fantastic. The last question for you is, what's the first step we should take to get to clarity?
You know, I would say this, and it's a mental leap, okay? And it's one of the hardest ones. The mental leap you've got to make to get to clarity is to say to yourself, I am going to say no to business that's not a fit. I'm not going to chase revenue. I'm not going to just grab anything. I'm not going to do will work for food. I'm going to make this decision that I'm going to go after the ideal fit, the best type of customer, and I'm going to learn to say no. And the saying yes to clarity is a saying no to all the other vague stuff. And once I can get someone to cross that river, then they're on the pathway. Some people never get there. They can't give up the idea that got to do anything or everything for anybody. And they'll never get to clarity. But once you're burned enough times, you finally say, you know what, I really want to pursue the best thing here.
Well, I think unfortunately that's fear, right? This kind of, if I say no to this, I'm losing out. I lose money. I lose credibility. Nobody's going to call me. I don't have enough money. I mean, there's a million reasons why we say yes to too many things. I want to ask you a question about saying no, because I think it's one of those things that's A, easier said than done. And B, I think there are some cases, and you and I were talking about a little bit about this offline, where new opportunities present themselves that are actually in alignment with our DNA, but we haven't thought of them. So how do you gauge? Actually, let me give the listeners an example. Or maybe actually, Steve, maybe you can, because you were talking about it with your business and the teamwork. How do we gauge when it's that versus not part of the DNA?
That is, for me, that's when I use the word adjacent a lot. So some of our best opportunities come in something that's adjacent, that's just a little different from what we were doing, an industry that's perhaps very related to the one we're in, an offering that's close to what we do, but a little different. And adjacency is something we need to pay attention to. So I have had the surprise, and you and I talked about this before we started today, of releasing a book about clarity that focuses very much on outward clarity, brand messaging, marketing, selling, referrals, all this business growth. But even since releasing the book, what I have found is my corporate clients have been asking me more and more for this adjacent consulting and workshop stuff on internal corporate communication, collaboration. And so over the last 8 months, I've actually spent most of my time developing this other branch of the tree, this adjacent branch. Really, it's an adjacent trunk of the tree. It's built on clarity, but it's an application of clarity to a different need area. And it's been fascinating. And there's a lot of money in that little niche. So I'm going after that niche while also my traditional outward facing clarity niche for small companies. And I'm just going to keep pursuing both of them. And then maybe in 2 years, something else will come up. That's okay. So we have to keep our ears open. But if somebody came to me and said, you know, Steve, there's a real need for manufacturing porcelain frogs for gardens. Well, okay, you know, maybe there's a great need and maybe there's a lot of money in it, but it's not adjacent. It doesn't. Right. No, I'm not making frogs.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, I kind of knew that because we talked about it ahead of time, but I wanted you to address it because I do think there's a difference between, oh, I would have never thought to have used my product service expertise like that. And wow, I mean, I can do that, but it's outside my wheelhouse at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah, we have to listen to our customers. When I launched, I wrote a blog post when I launched 13 years ago, and I said, you know, I think I've got about 85% figured out, and I'm going to let the market tell me the other 15%. So I actually had a little bit of self-awareness. And so it turns out that the market will tell you what they want. You just have to kind of listen and say, yeah, I can do that. And actually, that really does fit my core, or that's a new niche that I can gladly occupy. So we shouldn't be so arrogant to think that we've got it all figured out right up front. Let's let our customers tell us what they really need.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we really only have half the information, you know, in some ways.
That's correct.
The marketplace tells us the rest. Steve, this was phenomenal. I feel a lot clearer coming out of this. Or actually, what I should say is I feel like I have some work to do to get clearer. That's probably more accurate. But thank you for coming by.
Well, Tamara, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.